evapotranspiration. So it's the water, you know, coming up off the soil and the water coming up through the plant. And so, you know, a little bit of fertility can force a denser canopy, which then brings that E side of ET down. Too much nitrogen can force the plant into growth mode, and you can force that T side of that equation up. And so it's a real a balancing game there.
This is the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. Yara is the global leader in crop nutrition knowledge and the leading producer of quality fertilizer products. The podcast is intended to facilitate the transfer of knowledge for farmers and crop advisors, improving farm profitability and environmental sustainability. With Yara, knowledge grows.
Thanks for joining another edition of the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. My name is Scott Warr, and we are here with Neil Mayberry, our turf and ornamental crop manager. He's been on this podcast many times before. In fact, he's hosted it by himself. I don't know where I was. I think I must have been in an orchard somewhere, and Neil had to do it himself and did it very well, by the way. We have a couple guests today, Dr. Brian Unruh and Dr. Marco Skivan, who are going to help us learn about turf. You know, it's springtime right now across the United States, and that's a time where, you know, we put on our gloves and we go inside our houses and we do some spring cleaning, and it's kind of a rebirth. And it's not indifferent for turf and ornamental. And today we're going to talk about coming out of winter with turf and going into spring, and what kind of things you as a turf manager need to know about the agronomics and nutrition of turf. And from a couple different perspectives, Dr. Unruh has spent most of his career over in Florida and on the southeast part of the country. And Dr. Skivan, you spent a lot of your time in the West, is that correct?
Yeah, in the Southwest, yes. Got my PhD at New Mexico State, and then I spent 7 years in California.
So we're gonna bookend this discussion from the Southwest to the Southeast and see, are there some similarities? Are there some differences in managing turf? Neil, as a former golf course superintendent, what were you thinking coming out of winter and going into spring? What was tip of your mind?
Well, number one, being a golf course superintendent is the biggest thing is how we're going to impress our customers, you know, give them the best quality conditions possible. And, you know, the biggest thing is when the temperatures are going to be right. We always use a rule of thumb where the nighttime lows and the daytime highs, when it equals 150 for at least 7 consecutive days, then it was go time. It was time to start fertilizing and getting aggressive.
How did you prepare for spring as you were going into winter? Are there certain things that you did or prepared yourself for in the winter so that when you did hit that magic 150 degrees, that everything lined up perfectly?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The fall preparations just as important as the spring transition. You know, how you prep yourself for winter really depicts how you come out in the spring in a lot of cases. And of course, it all depends on what type of winter you get. When I mentioned what type of winter, how extreme it can get, you know, how low the temperature can get. And obviously, it depends on where you're at. You know, fall fertilization can be just as critical as the right timing of the spring fertilization as well.
Dr. Skivan, in your experience in the Southwest, what kind of things were you thinking about in the winter to set yourself up for a productive spring?
Well, first of all, New Mexico and California had quite different environments. And if we're talking about golf point of view, the number one thing would be knowing what kind of species are you managing, cool season or warm season, because they have two really different management practices depending on temperature. Of course, cool season turf grasses are growing more actively during the spring and during the the fall. And that's when you actually have to manage them and promote their growth by fertilizing more heavily rather than fertilizing during summer. While if you're managing a warm season species, you want to start fertilizing later during the year, maybe, well, depending. California, first fertilization would have been for Bermuda grass, would have been around May, let's say end of May or beginning of June. And then you want to fertilize through the summertime. While for cool season turf grasses, you can start fertilizing way earlier, even before Easter. You would have probably at this time for a tall fescue or Kentucky bluegrass, you would have already put out your first fertilization of the year.
Dr. Unruh, what kind of species do you have on the southeast that you need to worry about, like Dr. Scavante talked about?
Sure. I think, well, you know, when we think about golf side of things, I mean, Bermuda grass is king, and it has been for years. And then we have a little bit in our coastal environments, a little bit of seashore pastfalum, but really limited. And then we're really starting to see some zoysia grass coming along. And so, but again, by and large, you know, across that southeast, it's Bermuda grass that's on, you know, the majority of our golf courses.
Does Bermuda grass go into a hibernation during the winter?
Hibernation, that's an interesting term.
Oh, sorry. That's why Neil's here. Neil's here to say, hit the buzzer and say, that's not a term we use in turf grass, Scott.
You know, we talk about, I mean, dormancy would be the better.
Dormancy, there we go.
And of course, here in Florida, I mean, you can go out in kind of the dead of winter and Bermuda grass will be brown. In the northern parts of Florida where I'm based. But I learned early in my career at the University of Florida through some herbicide trials on what I thought were dormant fairways, number 18 to be precise. And I had sprayed a herbicide that you can apply on dormant Bermuda grass. And all was well until spring transition. And I went and right down the middle of 18 fairway, there were a bunch of dead squares. And I learned very quickly that though that Bermuda grass is brown, it is not dormant, truly dormant. But we do see it slow down. I mean, even in Key West, I mean, when we look at some growth potential models at Key West in like December and January, we're at only like 40% growth potential. So it slows down, which is an interesting switch because especially in South Florida, south of Interstate 4, which is that Orlando corridor, you know, our snowbirds flock to Florida and they play golf all winter. And so we have a grass that really is not at its prime, but is being beat to death by all these golfers that have moved, you know, to the winter moved to Florida for the winter months. So,
You know, that's a really good point, and I'm sure that Dr. Scavon saw the same thing in Arizona as the people from Idaho and Utah kind of moved south for the winter. And here you have a grass that's going into dormancy, but an increase number of rounds that are getting played on it. How do you deal with that?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was based in UC Riverside, which is 60 miles east of LA. If you kept going another 60 miles east, then you would get to Palm Desert, Palm Springs, and those are huge winter destination, and especially for golf. All those courses there in the Coachella Valley, they would actually oversee their fairways, while possibly lower hand golf courses towards coastal California, they would, or in New Mexico either, they would not oversee. And actually golfers can play on dormant grass, on dormant Bermuda grass. It's actually a misconception that playing on dormant grass ruin your game. You can totally play on dormant grass and the grass will come back no problem the following year and will recover the devo if there's any.
Neil, do you play better on dormant Bermuda grass or on green summer growing Bermuda grass?
It just all depends on your handicap. From my perspective, I play better on the dark green, thick grass. Yeah, it's more cushion and easier to strike the ball. But, you know, from a better golfer standpoint, dormant Bermuda grass actually provides an awesome surface.
Interesting. So let's say that we did everything and prepared as best we could for the winter, and everything's all set up and you're feeling pretty good about your practices. And like you said, Neil, we're in the spring, we're looking for that 150 degrees, and that's when we can start to apply our first shot of nutrition to these turf grasses. Let's talk about the four R's of turf grass stewardship. What kind of products are you applying in the spring, Neil?
Well, it depends on what type of segment, whether it's golf or lawn care and type of grass. And I mean, from a cool season to warm season grass perspective, it can vary quite drastically. But from, you know, we'll just keep it from warm season perspective, you know, especially in lawn care right now, a lot of times, you know, what will happen is, you know, I get the question all the time is, you know, what should I be putting on my lawn right now? Well, you know, it depends. It's still a little early depending on where you're at. You know, like I said, you know, I like for, you know, the nighttime temperature to the daytime high to equal that 150 mark for, you know, at least 7 days. You know, soluble sources, depending on the rate, can provide a initial upfront impact to growth, but we got to be careful. We don't want to overdo it because shoot growth comes at the expense of carbohydrate reserves and of your root. If you put too much out too quick, your shoot to root ratio will drastically be effective. And reason why that's a big deal is because if you put it out too early, then you get a heavy freeze or a frost afterwards. It could be very detrimental to the overall transition of your grass.
Can I expand on it? The carbohydrate reserve, it's actually something really interesting. I've studied that for my master's thesis while I was in Italy. You can tell from my accent that I'm not from the US. And we were actually, well, I am from Northern Italy, kind of Venice area. I studied 30 kilometers south of Venice. I would say if I have to translate it to the US, it's kind of like Arkansas weather, more or less. Okay. So we're still in the transition zone. But historically in Europe, we didn't really have warm season grasses in the transition zones. And I studied introduction of new Bermuda grass cultivars in those kind of environments. Specifically, I actually studied how carbohydrates get digested or accumulate during different seasons. And what Neil says is exactly spot on. You can clearly see an accumulation of carbohydrates on Bermuda grass shoots, stolons, and rhizomes starting from September, October, going up, up, up. Basically, those carbohydrates are not being digested because they're not being used for growth. And then when basically the grass senses the transition from winter to spring, you can clearly see free fall of carbohydrate content because the grass is actually starting metabolizing them to produce new shoots. And that changes from year to year. Actually, if you have a milder winter, you will see a lower peak of carbohydrates and you will see the fall of carbohydrate content before. And you definitely don't want to have, you want to have the grass reserve carbohydrates in its shoots. And you don't want the grass to digest it during the winter, because otherwise, if you're going to have a late frost and you have green tissues and you are pushing that grass, you are making that grass actively growing, and you have a late frost, then you may actually do some serious damage.
But I think, you know, when we look at this and species specific, you know, in where I'm at, you know, let's you know, move from the golf course, go out into the urban landscape. And so in my 25 years here in Florida, we made the decision when we started looking at our fertility rates for our lawn grasses. If you look at our North Florida recommendations, for lawn grasses, we don't recommend fertilizer before mid-April. So I'm kind of known for, you know, pay your taxes April 15th and then fertilize your lawn and do it in that order. And the reason for that is because, you know, a predominant lawn grass in North Florida is centipede grass. And centipede grass is really, it's the poor man's grass. We call it that. And it doesn't like a lot of inputs. I mean, it does just fine out in a pasture. And then they, you know, harvest it and bring it in and put it in the landscape. And it'll go south in about 4 or 5 years on you. And it's because it's overdone. But what's fascinating about centipede and some work Jack Fry did years ago when he was at LSU demonstrated that centipede grass takes about 14 days to enter into this dormancy, you know, hibernation, as you call it. And interestingly, it only takes about 72 hours to break dormancy. And so what happens with centipede grass is you kind of get this roller coaster of spring weather. So like we were in the 80s last week and centipede grass is by and large green as a gourd. But next or later this week, I think we're predicted to go down to 37 degrees. And it's not uncommon for us in the panhandle of Florida to get a first week of April frost. And if that centipede grass has gone through this roller coaster of green up, dormant, when it's finally time to go, you know, there isn't any more gas in that, you know, carbohydrate gas tank. And it will just, it just declines. And we, you know, we actually have a little term we call, you know, centipede decline. And it's a combination of a lot of factors, but, and I think zoysia grass is another one that we just don't understand zoysia. And I'm pretty convinced that it is, it's even cultivar specific, because I have seen just in our research plots where you have cultivars of zoysia grass. I'm not talking, you know, species. I'm talking cultivars that just respond very differently to, you know, to springtime temperature. You know, zoysias typically are the last, you know, to green up in the spring of the warm season grasses and the first to go, you know, sort of dormant in the fall. You know, we just don't fully understand that. And so I'm very cautious. And then when we couple, you know, environmental impact as well, we tend to think about, you know, if you look at the research for decades, it was all focused kind of on the beauty pageant side of grasses. How do they look? And then really kind of this movement, you know, of coupling the environmental impact of fertilizer, you know, and fertility. And you talk about the four R's, you know, and how do we bring those together? Because just because it may do something good for the turf doesn't necessarily mean it's good for the environment. And we get a tremendous amount of rainfall in the upper Gulf Coast, really from January through April, tremendous amount of rainfall. And so these grasses are not assimilating those applied nutrients because they're in some level of dormancy or hibernation. And so that fertilizer cannot, you know, won't be assimilated like it would be when we're actively growing.
And I would think too, with those heavy rains, if you are applying any fertilizer, it's not going where you want it to go. It may be running off or leaching through beyond the root zone, right?
It's absolutely true.
Neil, is there, from what I'm understanding from the discussion, is there is a risk if you're applying any kind of nutrition too early. So is it better to err on applying this nutrition plan late?
Just depends on, you know, specifically what we're talking about, because every situation is going to be different. But if I had to err, you know, I'd want to err probably a little bit late versus too early. And again, you know, the right placement, right rate, right source is so critical, because, you know, I can tell you, just like Dr. Unruh had just spoke, you know, we have, you know, some of my neighbors have applied fertilizer to their centipede and other types of grasses, and they've did that 2 or 3 weeks ago, and now we have this cool front coming in this upcoming weekend, and it's supposed to dip down into 30s. So if we get a frost, you know, like he, I witnessed it firsthand, like he's speaking about the centipede decline, where you get this, it's almost kind of like a off color yellow look. And it, you know, it occurs, you know, simultaneously, you know, right after that cool down period, you know, you have all this fertilizer and the grass can't utilize it. So, you know, obviously it's going to take in as much as it can, but you know, again, at the expense of the roots. And you know, if it's Bermuda grass we're talking about, you know, it could be at the expense of rhizomes and stolons.
What if you make a mistake and you start too early? What is the risk, and can you recoup?
Well, with warm season turf grasses, generally speaking, yes, you can. You will have a full green up later in the season, but warm season turf grasses, they have the ability to regenerate themselves, fortunately. So especially species with a high rhizome content, they will regenerate themselves. The other problem I see that Neil and Brian haven't talked yet is you actually, if you don't manage your nitrogen content correctly, especially early in the season, you may run the risk of increasing large patch incidents. And that is particularly true for zoysia and for St. Augustine grass. But also Bermuda grass, I've seen too much nitrogen too early. I've seen Bermuda grass getting large patch even in California, where it's really usually uncommon. Can you recoup? Yeah, you will just have to wait for higher temperatures, wait for that growing potential to be fully developed, and then at that point, start with your best management practices, so to speak.
One of the things that I found impressive with both of your experience and research is both of you have been focused on drought conditions. And I'm in Northern California right now, and the big talk amongst the ag people that I deal with is it looks like it's going to be another drought for us in California. We're going into another cycle. Tell us a little bit about how to manage turf grass with drought. Dr. Unruh, over your 25 years of research, what have you figured out and what are the solutions? Putting you on the spot.
Put me on the spot. Well, it's interesting. So there are four drivers. I mean, we have the four R's on fertilizer, but there's four drivers of plant growth: water, light, temperature, and nutrition. And if any one of those gets out of whack, you know, then we either have to compensate with something else, you know, to a point. And so we can talk about nutrition. We can be spot on with our nutrition. You know, we talked about the temperature side and the sum of the night and the day temperature is 150. We haven't really discussed light, and light is a key component. We've done a lot of work on that. Then we come down to water, and it's interesting. So you look at the California drought or the Texas drought, and that's serious. You know, I mean, there is no water. What happens in the Southeast in our sandy soils, you know, I get 60, 65 inches of rain a year and I have drought, but my droughts are short term. South Florida, we talk about the dry season and the wet season. It's really kind of relevant because even Central Florida and South Florida still gets 50 inches of rain a year. But when you couple that limited rainfall in those particular periods of time with the sandy soils, we end up with droughty conditions. So Dr. Skivon and myself, we just finished a project that was funded by the Florida Gulf Coast Superintendents and the USGA, where we were kind of looking at that intersection between drought or deficit irrigation and nitrogen fertility, because they're definitely, you know, interrelated. So I have a very large linear gradient irrigation facility, which I can go from 0 to 120% of what the plant needs. And then we stripped fertility across those. And then there were seven different Bermuda grass cultivars on this thing. So we can go in and pretty well tell, you know, if in your drier conditions, if you force a little bit too much nutrition on it, you're going to create a kind of a water demand. But there's a pinch point as well. Cause I mean, the plant, you know, evapotranspiration. So it's the water, you know, coming up off the soil and the water coming up through the plant. And so, you know, a little bit of fertility can force a denser canopy, which then brings that E side of ET down. And then, you know, a little bit too much nitrogen can force the plant into growth mode, and you can force that T side of that equation up. And so it's a real balance, a balancing game there. And so I don't necessarily have all kinds of answers for that. I just think you have to realize that both of those factors, you know, can drive some things. And so if you are predicting a drought is coming up, then maybe you want to pull that fertility back a bit. And it's all, that's all relative, to pull that fertility back a bit to lessen the demand that that plant's going to have for water. And so, and that's whether you're in a, you know, deep droughts of California or Texas, you know, very arid regions versus even our short-term droughts. And the genetics plays an impact in that as well. And that was probably the biggest difference in my location of that study that Dr. Skielon and I just completed. Very big differences in the genetics of the grasses that are out there.
The way drought is different from West Coast to Florida also mandates the way you manage it, the way you manage irrigation. Dr. Arul said, basically everything he said is right, is perfect. I just wanted to add one more thing. When watering in the desert Southwest, especially during summer times, when your evapotranspiration rates are, of course, for sure higher than your precipitation, then scheduling and exactly calculating your irrigation run times is crucial. If you want to do some deficit irrigation, possibly in the Southwest, in California, in New Mexico, deficit irrigation will be the number one strategy to irrigate, trying to save water. So basically, instead of replacing full ET, you would like to go down, try to replace 70% ET, and sometimes when conditions allow, even 50% ET, when you play with that nitrogen aspect. So basically, if you are on a water budget in the Southwest, my suggestion would be try to rationalize the amount of water that you're putting out. Don't put everything at once. Try to break it up into events while watering.
If you look at the textbooks that are written, turf grass management textbooks, they're all written by Northern people. I mean, almost every textbook we. Yeah. And what's really interesting is we make these broad statements, you know, to irrigate deep and infrequently. Well, that works in some places, but you head into the Southeast and you're not in control of what's falling from the sky. And so, you know, when the reason we deepen infrequent is, you know, we try to grow this great big old root system. Well, all bets are off in the Southeast because, you know, you can have this big old deep root system and then all of a sudden we head into 2 weeks of rainy weather and overcast weather and there goes your root system. I mean, and so, and then when you couple that with the sandy soils that don't have any water holding capacity, you know, it's and people hold up pictures of their roots, you know, and, that can all change, you know, in a week, in the Southeast.
You know, I think, one of the things I've learned from Neil over the course of the 3 years we've known each other is he says, I'm not growing grass, I'm growing roots. And that was a good paradigm shift for me. Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, yes, no, absolutely. And, you know, I'll echo some of the things Dr. Unruh, Dr. Skivan has alluded to. But, you know, in March, coming into spring transition, especially on a golf course green, I know this year has been a little bit wetter for March, but typically you have high winds and you're already coming out with, you know, limited roots because, again, you know, as you go through this roller coaster ride through the winter, especially in the Southeast where we have these warming periods, that's all at the expense of the roots, you know, the growth that we see. And time we get to March, you know, the root system, especially on ultra dwarf Bermuda grass greens, is very, very limited. And when you get these high winds in a sandy soil base, it doesn't hold water at all. And if you don't do more of a light irrigation system and give the greens the water when it needs it, you can run yourself a lot of risk and, you know, see a lot of decline on your greens and have a lot of unhappy customers really quick.
We saw, so in my 25 years here, I've been convinced, you know, that this, it is what you said about Neil, you know, growing roots, you know, you focus on the root system and the tops tend to take care of themselves unless you have some webworms and different things coming along. But, so we did a study several years ago, and we did it in Central Florida at our Gainesville location. And then I did it here where we inserted, we had all the different warm season grasses, not in a putting green scenario, but in a golf course fairway, as well as lawn height or rough height. And we inserted these plastic tubes into the ground, and then was able to secure a really expensive camera that takes pictures of roots. And so every 3 weeks for about 3 years, both in Central Florida and my location here, North Pensacola, we stuck the camera down those roots, and it takes a picture every centimeter down that tube. And those tubes are inserted at an angle, so then you can quantify and take pictures of roots. Some work that came out of Texas years ago that talk about the spring root dieback or root spring root dieback phenomena. It's not been studied very much, and I have now almost 700,000 digital images that we need to work through and analyze that. But I'm convinced that we see this spring root dieback. And we don't necessarily know all the conditions that exacerbate that. And it's not uniform across the profile. You'll see patches, and it's based kind of on the soil. I think it's based on some soil. But we do know that, you know, in a wet spring and a cool spring, that those conditions are exacerbated. And so, you know, bent grass, warm season folks know in the middle of the summer, your root system falls off. And you struggle through the heat of the summer because your root system is gone. That same thing is happening, I am convinced, in the spring of the year. And so we have some data from our Gainesville location that shows that pretty consistently over a couple of years. And you talk to sod growers, and they'll tell you that, you know, the worst time of year to try to lift sod is in the spring. And it's because that root system is gone. And so when we tie back kind of to the general discussion this morning, you know, is spring transition of turf. So you kind of have the temperature thing and the water thing and light, you know, and then your root system, you know, takes off on you and you got your real challenge.
Neil, is there something that we should be paying attention? I mean, when we talk about a nutrition program for spring, we all kind of default, well, we need to put some nitrogen on there. What other macro or micronutrients do we need to be paying attention to in the spring?
Well, Scott, you know, always revert back to balanced nutrition. I think it's very, very critical. But, you know, as our soil temperatures are starting to warm up, we have to remember, you know, other nutrients like phosphorus, potassium, you know, are probably going to be limited as well. But I will say, you know, we all need to start with the baseline soil test. I think that's the critical aspect before we get to deciding what type of fertilizer we want to apply. We need to understand what's in our soil, and we need to understand the limitations of what's in our soil. Again, phosphorus is very immobile. You know, if it's your soil's just, you know, right at the right, if it's not at the right temperature, it may be very limiting. And it plays a large part of what, you know, the health of the plant and the roots. And you got to remember, we just had this conversation about limiting roots in the spring. So when you have limited roots, all the nutrients are probably going to be limited at some point. You know, the roots aren't able to mine the nutrients like they normally would. So that's something to consider as well. You know, I always like to put out, you know, in the spring, I always like to recommend something like a 3:1:2 ratio, you know, nitrogen to phosphorus to potassium to get it started in the spring. I think that's always a good number. You can also add some slow release, but I do caution, I would not go 100% controlled release, because again, as your soil temperatures are just starting to warm up, based on what that release is, based on what temperature range, it could limit the amount of release and amount of nutrient availability to that plant.
Boy, I'm writing that down right now. I don't think I would have ever thought that there was a downside to slow release any time of the year, but it sounds like that there is. That's a good takeaway for me today.
Yes, and I see that happening a lot, Scott, where, you know, people put out, you know, anywhere from, you know, 60 to 100% slow release product, and they're curious why they don't see any response from that. And, you know, early spring, that could be a limiting factor. But I do, you know, I do recommend having a small portion of slow release in that early spring, because then it's going to feed for a lot longer period.
What are you excited about in your research right now?
Well, I think two things. I said from one side, you know, and we talk about best management practices. And so the thing, and it's not necessarily, you know, a research project that driven it, that has driven this, but, you know, in late 2015, the Golf Course Superintendents Association contracted with me and my team to develop the National Golf Course BMP Initiative. We developed the content behind this super secret magic curtain. And the goal was that all 50 states would have a BMP manual for golf, for their golf industry by the year 2020. You know, and the cool thing is that we met that goal. And so in December, it was announced that all 50 states have a BMP manual. And so just super exciting to be, you know, part of that. And now our shift is focused where we want every golf course in the nation to go in and clone their state-specific BMP manual to develop a facility-level BMP manual. And so that initiative is wide open right now. And so that's really a cool thing that I think that's out there. And then from the research side of things, you know, one of the things is I find exciting is in the big ag, this discussion about soil health has really become front and center. And there's some people playing around with that in turf. And to me, that's pretty interesting. You know, most of the soil health parameters that are out there right now, I mean, clearly have not been evaluated from a turf perspective. And I think there's some great limitations there. You know, putting greens are crazy dynamic. And so I have some real concerns there. But, you know, the contribution of organic matter or the lack of organic matter, you know, and how does that drive our fertility programs? And so we're looking at some of that, the genetics that are out there, some of the new grasses that are coming down the pike. A lot, especially in the Southeast, have been driven by this federal funding of five states, Texas A&M, Oklahoma State, University of Georgia, University of Florida, and North Carolina State, and where these breeders have been for the last 7, 8, 9 years and been partnering together to develop new grasses. And grasses like Tiff Tuff came out of that. And so it's been kind of cool, you know, to be able to be part of that project and see just the improvement of genetics. And we're just at the tip of that iceberg, so to speak. I think you're going to see some really cool stuff coming down from that.
And University of California, Riverside joined that group, the five university group, in the actually last proposal. And they are about, I don't want to say a date, but they're really close to release their first bred cultivar, improved cultivar. Which is a cultivar that has the ability to stay green for longer during the winter time. So it has the ability to have a really short dormancy period. And it's going to be a cultivar. This one, the first one they're releasing, it's probably going to be adapted more for Southern California, Arizona, Nevada. But that would be a game changer if he will be able to stay green 365 days a year. That will be a game changer for the market for sure. And another thing I am excited about, or at least new technologies, gadgets, and gizmos. Dr. Unruh talked about soil. I would like to talk about the air on the other side. I think we're not there yet. I am not a computer scientist at all. I use my office and my browser, and that's about it. But I believe that enhancing management strategies through artificial intelligence and remote sensing, so drones and stuff like that, it has a lot of potential in the future. I think we still need to actually develop a good program for it. So know what to do with the data that these drones and these cameras and images provide us. But I think in the future, it can have a lot of potential for golf courses.
Excellent. If people want to learn more, well, actually, before that, Dr. Unruh, you mentioned the National BMP manuals. I'm sure that a lot of people that are listening to this know where to find those, but there's probably some that don't. Where would one go to find those manuals?
Yeah, just go to gcsaa.org, and then right up there at the top, click on the environment tab and then drop down, and then there's all kinds of information on the BMPs. And so you can click into that and head to the facility. There's discussion there about the facility tool. And so as a GCSA member, when you log in with your credentials on that BMP site, literally within three mouse clicks, you can create your facility manual. That three mouse clicks clones your state manual. And then you go in and can work through it and edit it and add to your heart's content. GCSA.org, and then middle of that environment tab, and then click down from there.
Okay. And then if someone wants to learn more about the huge library of research both of you have done, Dr. Unruh, I know that we have gatorturf.com. Where else can they go to find out more about what you've learned and have been teaching?
So now you have, that means I have to update that website. that's the real challenge is websites and creating, content. I think, I'm a bit active on Twitter, though I don't rank in the metrics, and nobody has ever, I've never been trending on Twitter, but at JB Unruh, is my Twitter handle. And that's where, we tend to push a lot of, observations from the field or cool things, or, some people call me the paparazzi of turf because I go around and take pictures of stupidity happening. And when it's pouring down rain and sprinklers are running, or, I try to protect the innocent, and indict the foolish,
I want to know if you have an Instagram account for those 7,000 pictures of roots yet.
700,000.
Oh, 700,000. That would be you could break Instagram with that, Dr. Unruh.
I think I have an Instagram account, I'm aging myself. I'm not as active as I should be there. So,
Dr. Skavon, how can people reach you and learn more about what you're doing?
Is same as Dr. Unruh. My Twitter handle is FLREC Turf. I don't have an Instagram account, but yeah, we should probably develop it. But also the UF Turf team has a joint Twitter handle, which is, do you remember how is it, Brian?
UF Turfgrass Team, I think.
Yeah, as easy as that, UF Turfgrass Team.
If you didn't catch that, you're driving down the road or you're in your golf cart looking at the greens, I'll have that in the show notes so that you can do a quick link. Neil, how can you find out more about what Yara's doing on the turf grass side?
Sure. You can go to the website, yara.us, and search turf nutrition, or you can follow us on Twitter, OptimumTurf_YNA.
We'd like to thank Dr. Brian Unruh and Dr. Marco Skavon and our own Neil Mayberry, who's our crop manager for turf and ornamental, and the knowledge that they shared with us about turf nutrition, especially this spring as it's coming out of dormancy and getting its early start this spring. We appreciate the things that we've learned, and hopefully we can implement some of those great tactics and grow a great turf crop this year. We hope this grew your knowledge.
You've been listening to the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. For more information about our company, please visit us at www.yara.com or yara.us, or for Canada, yaracanada.ca.